Say you're driving on a winding country road or hiking in the woods. Maybe you know the territory, maybe you don't, and at some point you get a little turned around. Not lost exactly.
Although, come to think of it, maybe you are lost, completely disoriented, an experience we'd all love to forget. Unless you study such things for a living, then you'd want to write it all down in a book. NPR's David Green, who showed a very good sense of direction in this chair the last couple of weeks, has our story.
The new book we're speaking of is called You Are Here, Why We Can Find Our Way to the Moon, but Get Lost in the Mall.
Let's get lost.
Excellent.
The author is Colin Ellard. He's a psychologist who's fascinated by how humans get around in the wild and really anywhere in the world. So that's where we take him, out of the studio, onto the streets, to show us some tricks that we can use to find our way.
Okay. Who's got the GPS?
He's kidding. We don't have a GPS, but we do have a map.
Okay. So we're at Argyle and Allison.
Right there.
And we're trying to get into this chunk of Rock Creek Park.
We want to walk from this residential street in Washington, D.C. to find this nearby patch of woods. No problem. We're guys. This is what guys do. Except as we walk, we get to talking about GPS systems, as a matter of fact. And suddenly, I am not exactly sure where we are.
Using GPS.
And okay, so I'm going to stop you for one second because I literally don't know where I'm going. Already. Okay. This is really sort of embarrassing. Okay, and Argo.
Yeah, see, this is not embarrassing at all. What we're doing is human. It's absolutely human. Because here we are. We're not here at all. Right now, we're up in space talking about GPS satellites.
So that was a distraction, us chatting right there.
Yeah. And that just has to happen for a couple of seconds, and you can be completely lost.
And we humans are good at getting lost, because we're good at being so many places at once. As your feet wander down the street, your brain might be thinking about outer space, or maybe your vacation in Vegas. So it's easy to zone out about where you actually are. Now, you can train yourself to be more conscious of your surroundings. For example, if you want to remember where you parked the car, Ellard says you could make up a story about something nearby.
Let's look around here. Just, you know, this house that we're looking at across the street. It's an interesting house. There's almost like a Romeo and Juliet balcony on the second floor with sliding doors. You know, immediately that kind of conjures a story that, you know, you could imagine Juliet.
Juliet out on
the balcony. That little snippet, we've talked about that for 10 seconds. Are you ever going to forget that house now?
Probably not for a while.
Yeah.
And this is where I should mention that Colin Ellard and I are not alone. My editor has joined us for this walk, and she's a woman. Her gender, not an irrelevant detail, which we learn when we come to a fork in the road.
So we are going this way. No, we're not going that way.
We're going that way.
Didn't we want to make a... Yeah, we're going that way. That was my thought exactly.
Without the help of any map, our editor, Laura Krantz, has found the right way to the park.
Do you want to know how I knew?
Please.
No outlet.
Oh.
Means it's going to run right into the park.
Does she sound a little smug to you there? Just a little, maybe? Well, never mind. She saw the no outlet sign and, I guess, figured the park was just beyond it. Which led us to pose that inevitable question to Colin Ellard. Are men and women actually different in the way they navigate?
I see that in the contrast of my wife's style of navigation and mine. The best example is that some time ago I called her on my cell phone and I said, meet me at the northeast corner of King and Queen Street. And her response was, don't tell me northeast.
It's exactly what my wife says.
She said, tell me what you can see, right? Look across the road, what's there, and then I'll know where you are.
Common thing, women are less able to sort of know directions, cardinal directions, northeast, south?
I wouldn't make a grand sweeping generalization and say that men do the compass and women do landmarks, but there is a tendency for the mean kind of navigational style for women to be more towards the landmark end of things and the mean style for men to be more towards the compass direction things.
Finally, we step out of civilization and into these lush woods. To test our sense of direction, we purposely veer off the dirt trail and walk several hundred feet into a stand of tall trees.
When people are walking through dense vegetation like this, it can even be difficult for us to know that we're walking in a straight line. You can easily make really quite remarkable turns while still thinking that you've walked in a straight line.
And what would the implications of that be? I would sort of keep thinking to myself, well, I'm going in the right direction.
That's right. So you're well off course. People are reluctant to admit to themselves that they don't know where they are. There's often a tendency for people to actually speed up in their movement. So you might say, if I just make a left turn here and go, then I'll be back to home base. And then when you make that kind of decision, you start to
You really want to be right.
You start to march. And then if you're marching in the wrong direction, then you're getting farther away faster.
And what would the right answer be? At what point are there some good decisions that you could make to get yourself back?
Once you're lost, the best decision is always to stop.
Stop.
That's right. It's that same old rule that we learned back in scouting. Unless you're running from a bear or some other danger, just stay put. Now, Ellard also tells me that one of the hardest tricks for humans to learn is that sometimes, and in some places, it's okay to get lost, at least for a little while.
One of the things that you see all the time, and I'm as guilty as anybody else of this, and I fight the impulse in myself, is that anxiety about not knowing where you are. A lot of the time, that's not necessary. And there's nothing wrong with having the experience of losing our way for a bit and understanding how it feels and paying careful attention to what we do about it.
We've been wandering around with Colin Ellard, professor of psychology at the University of Waterloo in Ontario, and that would be north. His new book is called You Are Here, Why We Can Find Our Way to the Moon But Get Lost in the Mall. I'm David Green, NPR News.
Here at NPR, we like to tell it like it is. We try not to skirt the issues. We know we'll get an earful if we let you listeners down. If you're scratching your head trying to figure out where I'm going with this, here's the bottom line. I've laid my hands on a new book of idioms compiled by Jag Bala, and he's here with me in the studio. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks, Melissa. It's my great pleasure. In fact, I'm a little bit excited about it. And as the Chinese might say, I have dancing eyebrows.
You have dancing eyebrows. Okay. Well, we should explain, as you might have gotten a hint there, that these are idioms from other languages presented in English. And the title of your book comes from an idiom from Russia. Here it is in Russian.
Я не вешу лапшу на уши.
Which means?
It means I'm not hanging noodles on your ears, which means I'm not pulling your leg.
I'm not hanging noodles on your ears, which is such a great expression. Do you know where that comes from?
I actually don't know the etymological roots of that. I had a decision to make early on in the book as to whether or not to go into a lot of detail on etymology, and it turns out etymology is quite contentious.
It is the title of your book. Weren't you curious? Didn't you want to ask some Russians? Why do you say that?
This is another interesting point about idioms is that often Russian speakers don't know why. Some of the roots of our expressions, idioms of this sort, are buried deep in cultural history. I do mention one example. To let the cat out of the bag is from a 16th century practice of substituting, instead of a pig, which is what most people were going to market to buy, substituting a cat literally in a bag. And if you didn't open the bag before you left the market, it would be too late to complain later. So, however, most modern English speakers have no idea that that's why we let the cat out of the bag.
Yeah. What does the word idiom come from?
Actually, it has the same root as the word idiosyncratic. It's Greek idios, and what it means is private or of one's own. And an idiom is an expression which has a meaning that is to some degree private. The technical definition of an idiom is a group of words always used together where the meaning of the expression is not clear from the words in it. A wonderful example from English would be, you know, he kicked the bucket. Unless you're an English speaker and you know that that means that somebody died, there's no way you could figure that out.
Well, let's talk for a moment about salt, which pops up throughout some of these idioms. In English, we have the expression, we take it with a grain of salt, meaning we don't necessarily believe it. In Russian, to welcome someone warmly, there's the idiom, to meet with bread and salt.
Встречать хлебом солью.
And in Spanish, if you are salted,
estar salado.
It means to be unlucky.
Salt does pop up everywhere, and it is kind of essential to a lot of different things about the way we live. In Arabic, you can actually accept a dinner invitation by saying, yes, I will take salt with you.
You know, we should say here that when we asked some of our colleagues to record these idioms in their native languages, a lot of them looked at these and said, I've never heard that before.
Sure. I've encountered that a lot now in talking to people about the book. You know, I've relied on dictionaries as sources of these idioms. In dictionaries, you will find all sorts of older and regional expressions. So all of the idioms in the book have a reference, a published reference.
It's fun to see where different cultures arrive at the same general idea, but using a different metaphor. In English, we would talk about a pot calling the kettle black. And here it is in Arabic. A camel can't see its own hump.
That's just a wonderful expression, and shows you how much languages can be a great indicator of what's important to a culture. One of my favorite German ones, for example, attests to their great obsession with meat. To live the life of Riley in German, to live a wonderful life, to live in luxury, is to live like a maggot in bacon.
Oh, I saw that. Yeah, yeah. There were a lot of countries that seem to have the equivalent of what we would say in English as a bad workman, a poor workman blames his tools. In Hindi, here it is.
Nach na jaane aangan tera.
And that means that for a bad dancer, the courtyard is uneven.
Don't blame the feet. Blame the floor.
Absolutely wonderful.
Well, Jagbala, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Jagbala is the author of the book I'm Not Hanging Noodles on Your Ears and Other Intriguing Idioms from Around the World. Now, I have to say my conversation with Jagbala only made me more curious about those hanging noodles. I remember the phrase, don't hang noodles on my ears, I think from a long ago Russian class. But as for where the idiom came from, no idea. We called on several Russian linguists for help, including the author of a Russian-English dictionary of idioms. She was stumped. An instructor of Russian humor and speech suggested that the Russian word for noodle, lapsha, sounds like a word that means to deceive, which might make sense since the idiom essentially means don't deceive me. Well, if any of you are able to puzzle it out, please write to us. Go to npr.org, click on Contact Us at the top of the page, and put idiom in the subject line. And while you're there, you can check out a gallery of cartoon drawings of the idioms from Jagbala's book. The town of Olewine, Iowa, population just under 7,000, is home to 13 churches, a refurbished main street, a new library with free high-speed internet. Olewine, Iowa is also home to Roland Jarvis, a former meatpacking worker who burned his house down in 2001. He was hallucinating that he saw black helicopters hovering overhead. He dumped chemicals down the drain in a panic, and the home that was also his meth lab went up in flames. He did, too. The story of Olewine and its infiltration by methamphetamine is told in the book Methland, The Death and Life of an American Small Town. The author is Nick Redding, who joins us now. And, Nick, this is an excruciating story of what happened to Roland Jarvis, burned so badly in that fire that he was begging the police to shoot him.
Yeah, I think he had third-degree burns over 78% of his body and spent 3 months in the burn unit in Iowa City.
And when you meet him in 2005, Roland Jarvis is still smoking meth, even though he pretty much has no fingers left because of what happened in that fire.
Yeah. In fact, he said that the first thing he did when he got back to Olewine was to do meth, and he sort of taught himself how to light a lighter with what was left of his hands and hold a pipe in his mouth.
And what you learned in Olewine is that there were many Roland Jarvises, maybe not to quite such an extreme degree, but that methamphetamine had completely taken over this small town. How is that possible?
You know, I think that there's a couple different facets of it, and part of it is that meth has for a long time been sort of the drug of the American working class. It's a drug that gives people inordinate amounts of energy and you don't have to eat, sleep, or drink water. So if you're somebody who works on a manufacturing line or does farm work or meat packing work, for instance, it's a drug that can sort of come in handy. So in terms of helping you to work harder, given the fact that making an honest dollar in places like Olewine has gotten harder over the years through the consolidation of the agricultural industry, there's been more of an onus placed on having to work harder for less. I think that contributed greatly to the attractiveness of methamphetamine.
Yeah, you tie the rise of meth in this town directly to what's going on with farming, with big agriculture, consolidation of industry, as you just mentioned.
Yeah. The principal industries that made rural America strong. almost all of those have been diminished to the point or been consolidated to the point that there's very little money left in that, and yet you have these places that are still left. And what do to be able to survive?
One of the big industries in old wine traditionally was meatpacking. And what did you hear from people there who worked as meatpackers about what had happened with consolidation and wages?
Well, at one time, there was a meatpacking plant there owned by a company called Iowa Ham. This would be back in the 70s and the 80s. And back in 1987, you could make $18 an hour. That's good money. That's enough for a lower middle class living. Eventually, in I think about 92, the plant was bought by Gillette, and wages went from $18 an hour to I think about $6.20. And then the plant was bought a couple more times throughout the course of the next 5 to 10 years. So if you're a guy like Roland Jarvis, and now you've got to work extra hard to be able to make less than you were yesterday, meth is often seen as a very helpful drug in that instance because you don't even have to go to bed before working your next shift. Eventually, a guy like Roland did the math and he said, well, I can either keep working twice as hard for a third of the money or I can just start making it myself and I will make a lot more money.
Make a lot more money by manufacturing meth.
Right.
You do describe that the police chief is able to make a pretty big dent in what's going on, at least with meth production in old wine. What did he do?
Right. Well, it's a little bit like what happened with Giuliani in New York City, and Bratton, I think, was his police chief. Anyway, but to not let any small things go unnoticed, meaning, if somebody is speeding just a little bit, then that constitutes speeding. So let's pull them over and use that as a legal excuse to see what's in the car. Because what was happening is a lot of people were driving around cooking meth in their cars and trucks to try and disperse the smell, the ether smell that comes from making meth. A lot of people were riding bicycles around with the same idea, cooking meth in plastic Pepsi bottles that they had strapped to the back fender of their bicycles. So the city council said, well, you can't ride your bike downtown anymore.
And did it work?
I think it worked incredibly well. Their small lab meth production plummeted to basically zero by sometime mid-2006. So to go from getting a lab every few days to having zero is a remarkable success.
But meth use is clearly still going on in old wine, Iowa.
It is, and I think that's where you have to look at the Mexican drug trafficking component of all this. When you take away the ability to make the stuff in your house, you're not taking away people's addiction to it. All you're doing is opening up the market to the trafficking organizations. Those are much more difficult to contend with.
What would you say to those who have reported in recent years that the meth epidemic was wildly overblown, contributed to this sort of frenzy of panic about meth?
I would say that I never saw any of them when I was walking down the street in Old Wine or in any of the other places that I spent 4 years going back and forth to. The thing that the media could justifiably be criticized for is missing the point with meth. The point is really not entirely that people make it in their homes. The point, I think, is that it stands for something much bigger in American culture, which is the demise of small-town America. So in some ways, I think the criticism that meth has been overblown, that misses the point in the same way that media attention to the drug has been missing it all along.
Well, Nick Redding, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Nick Redding is the author of Methland, The Death and Life of an American Small Town.